All right. Well, hey, listen, everybody. I promised you that I would have one of the most special guests. Bonus shows that we could possibly have, and always try and get out there and get somebody a little different. Now, you can listen to him because he's got one of the top podcasts out there as well, but we don't get a chance to talk an awful lot. And I reached out and said, hey, Jim Ross, would you like to come on and do a bonus show with me, and let's just talk about some old times, because people are always asking me about... Bruce, talk about your time in Mid-South Wrestling and how that was and what all the machinations of that was. Well, that was a lot of time spent with the one and only good old Jim Ross. JR, thanks for doing this.
You bet, buddy. My pleasure. The money you guys are paying, I can't turn this down.
Well, you know, you're getting paid exactly. John Layfield always brags about the kind of pay that he gets for doing guest appearances on our live show. And Layfield actually called me in the middle of a live Patreon Q&A, and I put him on. And in the middle of it, he says, hey, am I getting paid for this damn thing? So it happens. But yeah. I think you know, Jim, we always have fun with you on our podcasts and our live shows. And one of the things somebody wanted me to ask, and we should explain this here. Have you ever said the words sassafras?
I don't. You know, I get that all the time on social media from you, from your audience. I might have. I might have been drunk, but I don't remember saying sassafras on a ongoing or regular basis. But it is funny.
Well, yeah, and it comes from it's funny because I don't think you've ever said it, at least in my presence, but it was something that when Brian Gewirtz would do JR and we would talk about things, he would always end it with sassafras. And I picked that up and then I did it. We have it on the show. It's kind of like Bob Holly never actually uttered the words, hey, I got an idea, give me the belt. That was his idea, but he never actually uttered those words, and we had a lot of fun with it going back and forth. But that's not what we're about. JR, what the hell are you doing now, man? What's going on? Catch everybody up with where they can find you, what the hell you're up to, and then let's dig into some old Mid-South stories.
Well, Bruce, you know, I'm just trying to stay busy. It's as we record this on Valentine's Day, it's another Valentine's Day of that my little angel Jan here. So that's always an ever-going, ever-evolving adjustment to try to address her absence. So that on a personal side, my health's good. My grandkids are good. My daughters are good. Everybody's healthy, thank God. I'm working on my second Sovereign, the sequel to Sovereign Knocker, which is still selling there on Amazon.com. And we hope to have that book done and go to, you know, we're still shopping publishers, but we've got some good offers. So, but Paul O'Brien lives in Ireland, and I work on that 2 or 3 days a week. He works on it every day, and I get with him on 2 or 3 days a week. You know, like you guys, I'm booking some shows. Pardon me. I'm doing more cons, more comic con things than I have ever done. I got the show, you know, you and I and Conrad are collaborating on a After Raw show in New York. I think that show actually, those tickets are going to sell this Monday night or something. I believe 9 o'clock Eastern.
See, that's a nice little scoop for our Patreon folks. We haven't even announced that yet. We told everybody to stay tuned to social media. So that's a nice little scoop for us to get there that out there. And that's going to be a lot of fun. Because what else is there to do on a Monday night after Raw when you're there for the whole WrestleMania weekend?
Yeah, look at all the content that you experienced. So we'll have an unlimited amount of material to talk about, whether it be Ring of Honor in the Garden, or whether it be the WrestleMania event that's already happened, or Raw that night, or, you know, the NXT TakeOver, whatever it may be, all these different shows. And a lot of those folks, as you know, Brucey, they go home on Tuesday.
Yep.
A lot of the international travelers, of which there are many, will bolt on Tuesday because they've been there since Thursday or Friday. So, you know, you can only afford, some people can't afford to, it's just expensive. So I'm doing that, doing these shows. What else am I doing? Oh, I'm going to LA this weekend to do a 1-day movie shoot. So you can imagine how big that is. I got one day. It's a horror film, so I haven't seen the script yet, but I think it'll indicate that I get killed early.
I like
it. So I'm going to do that. Yeah, I'm going to do that on Saturday. Pay me and I'll go. Yeah, she, where's the paymaster? I'll take my check now, and I'll see you guys later. Thank you.
That's
right. So, you know, just I'm trying to not be as busy as I had been. When Jan got killed, I went kind of nuts on staying busy because I just couldn't stand to be home. And it was really depressing, and I was having problems, just emotional problems and worried about things and missing her and what could I have done and all these stupid things. So I've kind of gotten over that as far as that emotion is concerned. I still miss the hell out of her, don't get me wrong, but other than that, it's kind of leveling out a little bit. So I'm staying busy. I'm not as busy as you and Condra, and I'll be working at StarCast. I'll be booked there. I think I've got a couple of, told me a couple of assignments he wants me to do. I thought they were both good. I'm excited about those. So, and then,
he'll keep you busy.
You know, yeah. Well, that's good though. See, I'm at a point in my life where I really, really want to be busy, and not so much as my motivation previously has been where I want to go chase that next payday. Don't get me wrong. I don't work for free, but it's not just all about the payday. You know, get your room paid for and make a couple of bucks and spend several days in Las Vegas. That ain't a bad deal for me. You know, I like that. So I'm staying busy. I'm looking forward to our stuff that we're doing together and, you know, and all this thing. So it's good, man. And, you know, the business is changing and, you know, my status where I'm going to do going forward is evolving. And, you know, that's still a lot of moving parts. So hell, who knows what this year is going to hold, but I'm looking forward to it.
Well, should be at least very interesting, to say the very least. And we can say that our past and our history has been very interesting and a lot of fun, to say the least. And I always go back, and it's hard sometimes for people to understand that old territory system and how we work. But I was working in Houston for Paul Bosch. Pretty much all we did was promote one town. You are working for Mid-South Sports with Bill Watts. Bill buys into Houston, and all of a sudden, we're working together. And there was this mystery guy up in the Tulsa office there in Bixby, Oklahoma, who would send us cards and every once in a while send ideas down. And Paul would come in, and he would look at some of this sometimes and laugh and go, ha! You know, he's got this guy. He's a marketing genius. This Jim Ross. Oh yeah. Why don't we just have Slack night? Because business, you know, we had our ups and downs, and when we would come down, you would always fill us with ideas. Is why don't we try this? Why don't we? You didn't have to do it, but
Right. Why
don't we try this yet? And I think Paul kind of. The immediate first response was, how dare someone tell me how to run my town? But that's the first time I met you, and shit, we became friends pretty much right off the bat.
We did. We had a good run together there. Well, you know, Mr. Boss is a nice man, and he was so good to the community of Houston, honorable. You know, he was always spoken of with great reverence. But he was like a lot of old guys, like me now, that, you know, if you didn't see things his way, there was no agreement to this type of conversation. It became an issue. That's how a lot of those alpha males handle their issues. So instead of him getting pissed off at Bill for me sending ideas that I was instructed to send by the cowboy, and look, do you think that Bill didn't see these ideas before they went down there? Come on. So anyhow, nobody could say they're all good. They probably weren't. Maybe none of them were good. I don't know, but I was following my marching orders. But Paul would rather nail me because I was harmless than he would confront Bill. That's kind of my take on it. You were there close to that than me, but I never understood why we had an issue. I know that one time we were working out there at Ringside in Houston, and it was one of those nice Friday night shows and excitement and enthusiasm. And so we're working at Ringside with no headset and one mic, one stick mic that he helped fervently in his hand. It could have been pried from his hand with a crowbar. So then he would talk, and he would turn his back to me, sitting at the ringside. So it was so loud there, I couldn't even hear what he was saying. I rarely got a word in edgewise. And the problem with that is, not necessarily my very well-described and legitimate ego, was that Cowboy gave me specific information to get in, and I didn't do it because I couldn't get the mic in front of me. So I got my ass chewed out for not getting my – I think it was like a JYD thing or building something with JYD. And anyway, I said, well, your partner didn't share the mic. I don't know what I can tell you. You know, that ain't an issue for me to address.
Well, what was your role? We know what your role was somewhat, you know, in front of the camera. Your role wasn't as much as Boyd Pierce used to be, which Boyd Pierce's role was, howdy, folks, welcome to Mid-South Wrestling. Here's Bill. Yours was a little more than that.
I got cast in that same role in the beginning. I would say, here's Bill, and thanks for joining us. See you next week. That was kind of my idea. I knew those two things were going to happen. They open and they get the hell out. But I placed all the advertising buys in the territory, in the marketplace. I negotiated the TV deals with the syndicated network and produced interviews. You were part of that. And so I was kind of like, a man Friday, I guess. But the good thing about that was, as we all are, probably this very day, underpaid, at least in our egocentric minds. I think maybe Bill was, he was getting all he could out of everybody around him. And if you could add something, then he was all for it. So that's kind of what I did. I handled the syndication, the advertising, the promotion, the marketing, the appearances. I sat in with him and whoever the booker that was, on booking meetings. I sat in on the TV meetings, not that I had a major role, but some of it was just to write shit down so that we didn't forget to do it. You've been there. So, yep. It was all good, man. I like I was going to say, the thing I learned, Brucey, that it has served me and you, by the way, very, very well, is that we got great education from these elders who became great mentors. And even though their egos were massive and they were alpha males without question, they taught both of us a hell of a lot about the business. And for that, I'm always going to be grateful.
Yeah, without a doubt, because wouldn't be where we are today. And that was every time that you went to work, it was like going to school.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to absorb, you got to pick the brain of the guys that actually did it in history, were doing it then, and why. That was probably my favorite question so many times. For Bill, for Paul, for Vince, for everybody was, okay, why that decision? Why did you do that?
And yeah.
Sometimes they couldn't explain it.
Well, they couldn't because it's a gut feeling thing, an instinctual thing, and it's the old thing we've both heard. And wrestling fans listening to this should remember there's always more right ways to do something than the one that was picked. There are other ways to get something done. It's like looking at a trip. The destination doesn't change. It's to get a talent over and to monetize your money streams. So I think that, the goals in business never change. One of the things I find interesting in today is that I don't know how much today's talents get involved on their own creative and how they pitch ideas or how they speak up and they don't feel something's going to fit them or whatever. I can tell you that the main event guys – back in the Cowboys era, they were asked, what do you think? Give me an idea. And a lot of them have gone from territory to territory and worked the same basic thing. If you're a big heel, how did you get over in the Carolinas? Well, we did this, 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 and this, and this for 8 weeks, and we did this for 3 months, and all of a sudden, boom, I'm over. Okay. So you figure out ways to get a guy over that's worked before for him. And the other thing is that also ensures that this dude is going to buy into what you're doing because he's contributing to the creative. Nobody wants their creator to fail. That's why there's so many pissing contests and creative meetings, because everybody wants their idea to be used, and then they want their idea to be successful. And if the idea is not successful, they got to figure out a very quick creative way to to divert the heat so they don't take any of the, you know, they don't get blamed for anything. I didn't make a bad decision. Well, there's a lot of bad decisions made, but that don't, they ain't the end of the world either.
Exactly. What? So you started with Bill Watts what year?
74.
Wow. That's crazy, because I started selling posters of programs in Houston in 73, and you were working with Bill, and you're 10 years older than I am, so that's about right.
About right. Yeah. I was making 150 a week, all in. And no, you know, they were, well, that don't include your insurance. Well, yeah, it does.
Yeah.
And trance and everything.
So you were getting paid that money.
Yeah, right. 150 a week, buddy. 150 a week. And I was married. I was in marriage one at that time, and that was that 150 a week lessened the trips to the mall, I can tell you that.
And then, you know, when we got together, in the 80s, and that was some pretty crazy times, man, with the Midnight Express, Rock and Roll Express, and the territory was changing, because traditionally Mid-South had been kind of like us in Texas. That was always a big man territory and the big tough guys. And then Bill Dundee came in and brought some smaller stature wrestlers and put them on top, and they got over in that way, which I think was a surprise to a lot of people, but it was a surprise in a good way, because holy shit, man, it was some of the best workers in the business at the time.
That's a key thing you just said right there. When Watts went to Memphis to meet with Jerry Jarrett, one of your favorite subjects, that he found some guys they weren't using, and he had some ideas. He created the Midnight Express. He created, and the Rock and Roll Express are already made. They already had videos done, for God's sakes. They were great. So, but Bill, because I can tell you, Bill didn't think in the very beginning. He thought much like his peers, the Fritz Von Erichs and Paul Bosches and so forth. It was a big man's world, and he always thought that, well, the good news is that we bring these two teams in. If they got any chemistry at all, then at least that'll be a good semi-main or a good match to take us to break or whatever. Well, hell, nobody realized that they're going to become as big a stars as the company as the territory ever had. And that wasn't because they were small, obviously. It's because they were talented. So I like the fact that at least today's world, there'll always be a premium, Bruce, and you know this as well as I do, if not better, for the big guys. They're always going to get the first look. But with the women's revolution and the smaller guys getting a cup of coffee and more, you know, shoot, they're going to be, there's a place for all sizes if you got talent and you can connect with your audience.
Definitely. And it was also a change in booking philosophies too, because we had Ernie Ladd and some others in there. And I think Ernie was right before Bill Dundee, but it was a completely different philosophy as to how the entire territory was booked too.
Yeah. And here's the thing. People say, well, how does that work? Well, it works. Use this example. It might be more, part of every day. Look at a big time coach in a professional league. Every coach is going to, let's say a football coach, your guy down in Houston has got a style. He's got a, things he likes to do, he has his preferences, and so he has a different game than the other guys. That's the whole difference right there. It's just a preference, how you like to see the game presented or how you like to see the product presented. And Bill liked, you know, blood and guts and physicality and thunder and lightning and all that stuff. And he was not a high spot guy because he couldn't identify with that. He was never a high spot guy himself. He told me the other day, I had him on my podcast not too long ago, and he said, well, I don't get out much. He's sharp as a tack, and still opinionated, still headstrong, still cowboy, which is great. And he said, you know, I don't fly as much because out of here in the Panhandle, Florida, where he goes, it's I got these little planes. Over the years, my back's been really, you know, getting messing up. And I said, I don't know how your back could hurt because you never took any bumps. So, But yeah, that was a really an interesting education, and then understanding the business, Bruce, of this Booker system was really good for me as a student of the game. I'm sure for you too, but I love the process. I love to see how the process is going to work. And, God almighty, the things that Bill said to his bookers and those booking meetings, oh, my God, it was like, oh, we're going to get murdered. But he was just outgoing. He had no filter, so he said what the hell he wanted.
Well, it was his territory, so he could.
That's right.
He was the boss. He was the boss. You know, I look back fondly on the times that we would travel together, and we would do Houston television on a Friday night, and then we would fly Saturday morning to go do television at the Cowtown Coliseum in Fort Worth, and then we would go Sunday to do TV either in Tulsa or in Oklahoma City. And you and I would always travel together. We'd stay at that Holodome in Dallas, and then we would stay at the Two and a Half Seasons in Bixby, Oklahoma, as I used to like to call it.
And the first Far Eastern family who weren't the most popular people, unfortunately, for no reason, just people are stupid. But we stayed, when I got kicked out of my house on my second marriage, I lived at in Glenpool, Oklahoma at the Quality Inn or something like that. And that was a great place. And we got great rates, and the family were fans, and so that every now and then I slipped them a couple of tickets because the rates, and there was no checkout thing. It was all great until, but wait, there's more. The owner and his wife found the missing link performing Cunnilingus to his wife on the pool table in the game room. That pretty well ended the positive relationship that we had tried to build with that hotel, the Tala. And I begged the guy. I said, I got nowhere to go, man. I felt like some of those dramatic TV shows. I got nowhere to go, man. I got nothing. I got bad time for me.
It's the only hotel in town.
Yeah, and it was out there on the highway. They had there's food around it. There's a little bit of peace and quiet. It wasn't that far from Tulsa, maybe 20 minutes. From the arena and all that. And it was also close to the barn that we cut the interviews in.
Right.
Far, far from Bixby in Glenpool. So he relented and had a soft spot for me, and he let me stay in my room, and I never had to move out. But then we finally got into reconcile, and we told him that we have, I think it was one of those wrestling fines, that the missing link had been fined the largest amount of money in the history of Mid-South wrestling. For his actions, unprofessional actions in the green room on the pool table. And even though his beloved wife apparently was really enjoying it and making ample noise, it wasn't going to get over. Not going to happen. So, that's kind of how that is. So we did a storyline with the owner, and tell those little white lies like we did on television for a million years and about the fine, or he's suspended, or whatever. It's kind of like this Becky Lynch suspension. Becky Lynch is suspended about as much as you and me, and we ain't on team in that regard. So we're suspension. It's a work. And so the guy agreed. He said, "Well, did you fire the guy?" I said, "You'll never see him in your hotel again. I promise." So I didn't say no. We fired him. We didn't fire him. He was drawing money.
Yeah, and everybody needs a little pleasure every once in a while.
Yeah, even on the pool table.
Yeah.
With an audience.
Well, it happens. I can remember you, me, and Eddie Gilbert in the room on the second floor all the way down at the end, and we would get to discussing creative stories and telling stories, if you will. And it was awful foggy in that room from time to time. It would get kind of smoky and foggy in that room. And I'll never forget the words of wisdom. "Goddamn, Brucey, you ain't going to get any higher. You're only as high as you can get." And I was,
you had a great tolerance, much greater than I. I'm thinking, you're high as you're going to get, man. You're buzzed. You could eat a gallon bag of goddamn Doritos, onion dip, whatever. We all had the munchies. That's the sad thing about it. When you live in when you're in an area where accessibility is not really as what you want, and you got to take what's in the vending machines, right?
Right, yes.
Reminds me of a story. Pee Wee Anderson was JYD's caretaker on the road and driver and purveyor of things that he thought he needed. So I'm assuming he was a bag man. But nonetheless, everybody knew, and there was no policy against it anyway at that point. So the Pee Wee would walk around with a money bag, like a canvas money bag full of quarters. I mean, and I said, Pee Wee, what the hell are you? Because he brought them in the locker room. He didn't leave them in the car because you couldn't, somebody might steal those quarters. And I said, what are you doing? I said, well, a dog wants something to eat in the middle of the night. The only thing there is the vending machine. So I go down and get him. I said, what are you fucking getting? Well, Hershey bars, Snickers. So dog
Doritos.
Would get the munchies.
Yeah.
Yeah. Onion dip. And dog would get the Doritos. Or get the Doritos. Yeah, I got those too. Dog would get the munchies and send Pee Wee on a errand of mercy to take his big bag of quarters to the nearest vending machine and load up. So, and I told Bill, I said, you think, you and I may have talked about this too. You think JYD's gaining weight? Yeah. He didn't look like he used to look.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, maybe he's just off the sauce. But why would he be off the sauce? There's no rules against being on it. And I'm telling you, Bruce, I'm not a steroid guy or anabolic guy or chemist or nothing. But I really believe that the schedule that the guys in Mid-South had, where an average week was driving anywhere from 1,500 to 3,000 miles a week in your personal vehicle, getting no transportation money, that if you didn't take something, anabolics or some other substance, you probably wouldn't want to last very long because the schedule was just, it's just hard to believe how hard it was and then how hard they worked. If you and I have done this, seen this a million times. When Dr. Death or Jim Duggan, Buzz Sawyer, some of those big cats, delivered a clothesline, they didn't put their arm out there so somebody could run into it and then take their own bump.
They threw
that it. Sounds really cool, right? They threw it right through their chest.
Yep.
And if you lowered your face and tried to avoid it, then they go hit you right across the bridge of the nose, and that's not very pleasant. So I'm just saying that I don't know how guys would have made it with those tours every week. No off season. Every week, 7 days a week, there's shows running. And of course it comes back to this. Well, somebody else said, well, they should have just asked for a day off. That's really smart. They don't get paid. If you're not working, you don't get paid. So why do you work to get paid? So you work. It's real simple. And you work every damn day because you don't want to miss that one payday.
No kidding. And like you said, if you were hurt, nobody said anything about it because you didn't want to lose your spot. You didn't want to lose your payday. And if you missed one spot, it opened the door for someone else to step in and they might take it.
And our brethren in the wrestling business, not all of them, but more than you want to admit, were somewhat insecure, and they are easy to shake a little bit. But the insecurities and the paranoia that's one of the underbellies of pro wrestling that's just hard to get away from. And it was even worse back in the territory days, I think, because most of those dudes didn't even have a contract.
Right.
You could be gone. You could be gone tomorrow, legally, officially, and I'll see you. So I remember Bill bringing in Bull. Remember Bull Belinsky?
Absolutely.
He brought him in to do from Vern in AWA. Thought he could make him a big time character babyface. The truck driver thing, the horn, the whole nine yards, relate to the blue collar people. And in theory, that's logical. However, he didn't expect Belinsky to expose himself in the Channel 3 studios in Shreveport. And somebody was doing a promo, he walks over near the camera, you know, out in the camera range. The other people there could see it, and pulled out his Johnson to bust the interview and make the guy laugh. Well, I wish the guy did laugh. I didn't see it. I don't know if it was that big or that small, but nonetheless, the dude was disrupting the interviews, and Cowboy fired his ass on the spot. He just brought him in and put him on top. I asked him, "What?" That didn't take long. He said, "I saw all I need to see, kid. I saw all I need to see. It wasn't going to get any better. That's the kind of guy he is, and we don't need that kind of guy here." I said, "I can't afford to lose this TV station." So he's right about that. You can't lose your TV. So they were doing all of our production, as you know.
Yep.
They're producing the Mid-South Wrestling Show that aired in Houston and other places, and all the promos for all the whole territory, the upper half and the lower half. So it was a quite a machine. And Bruce, I was always amazed, you know, since our, you know, you started with Vince before me, and I was always amazed at how much work we got done in the Mid-South office and the Houston office, for that matter, as well, with such a small staff. Everybody was how many jobs did you have?
As many as I could handle, and we just had them. If we were there, it was. If you were breathing, you could do something. And so whether it was doing merchandise, whether it was going through and helping you with the markets and going through those Arbitron ratings back in the day, and then put me on TV to do the market-specific interviews, it was like, load him up. He's here. How much can we get out of him while he's here?
Yeah.
And that's what we did. If you were there, you were working. And if you got time to lean, you got time to clean, the old saying. And if you got time to be there, you got time to find something to do. Even if it was just going down in the basement there and folding shirts and counting pictures and seeing what we have, doing inventory. You're waiting for the next meeting? Learn something.
Yeah, I agree. It was something else. I had so much to learn. And I learned so much. I'm very thankful for that whole experience. And my friends, lifelong friends like you, and, you know, Cowboy's still my mentor. He's still I can always get an honest opinion from that son of a bitch. I can tell you that, boy. You don't mix words. He's a Vince McMahon guy. He tells you what time it is, so how to make the watch.
Right.
And the big old meetings we had back in the day, in the boardroom there at WWE, when somebody had the floor, and Vince sitting in his normal spot at the end of the table, you could read his face like a book, man. Like, he's getting ready. He's about 30 seconds away from shutting this shit down. And more often than not, we were right, because that person that's doing the talking did not espouse to the theory of less is more.
Yes.
What time is it? Don't tell me how to make the goddamn watch. Tell me what time it is. And Cowboy was a lot like that, too, because he didn't have a big staff to rely on. His most valuable asset was his time.
Yes, and Jim, you were there. We were in Bixby at the office, in Bill's office, and it was you, me, Ernie Ladd, Bill, and for some reason, I think Jack Curtis was there, but I don't know for sure. It actually might have been Scott Munns sitting in the meeting as well, but Ernie Ladd was extolling the virtues of Vince McMahon and explaining to Bill, "They got them, Bill, you look at Vince McMahon, the man is a genius. He's an absolute genius. I know Volkoff is the shits and the Iron Sheik is the shits, but they're real, Bill. He's a real Iranian. He's a real Russian. You can feel it. The man is a genius. He fired my ass. The man is a genius." And there was a pregnant pause.
I remember that pause
before I think all of us just started laughing at the same time, because it was, he's a genius. He fired my ass. And you know, the first time that Vince fired me, that's how he fired me. He says, "Brucey," in the immortal words of the Big Cat, and he held his hand out like, "That's your cue, pal." And I said, "You're a genius. I'm fired." "There you go, pal. You know I love you."
Yeah.
I'm like, "Yeah, but I'm fired, man."
Yeah. I got nowhere to go.
And it's funny because you and I had this damn reputation there, is that we'd been fired 800 times. And I would always correct him and go, "Hey, no, You've only fired me once. Now, you have wanted to fire me a lot more times. Yeah. But you know, come on. Come on, it's only happened once. Now it's twice, but still. At the time, you say, just wanting to fire me doesn't count for actually doing it.
Yeah, they can't count. That's not a good, that's not one. That's not official. Can't
no,
do that.
No, because
we'd
be in triple digits. You know,
yeah. I have this deal here. I got this, my phone's ringing, right?
Yep.
Nobody has, I think very few people have this number. So you know what it is? Solicitors.
Yes.
I hate these
Chinese.
Oh my God. I just hate those son of a bitch. I do the old Seinfeld thing. They call you around the dinner hour, like around 7:30. I'm sitting here trying to scrum up a little meal and, or grilling or something. And I say, hey, can I just call you right back? I'm grilling and I don't want my meat to burn. Can I call you right back? What's your home number? Click.
Exactly.
So it's, anyway, that's another one of my great adventures. I live a hell of a lifestyle, man. I am living on the fucking edge of reality. the Mid-South days were amazing, and the results of the ratings that we earned on the syndicated marketplaces, including Houston, was scary good. Even when the oil boom and the energy thing faded away, and there was mass unemployment and recession and all these things, people were getting foreclosed. They couldn't afford to go to pro wrestling matches or a lot of other extra things, but they damn sure could watch television. And the problem that we had there is that we didn't have the vehicle in place. We should have monetized our television vehicle better with ads, an ad network, find yourself some advertisers. And I tried to do that, but never found the right people to close the deal. That was the most passionate territory I think I ever worked in, Bruce. The fan heat in Houston or New Orleans or Tulsa, wherever. I can't say that I've wrestled or I've worked in front of a more vociferous, real, organic audience than those back in those days.
God, do you remember the security in Tulsa and the way that the audience would just come and swarm the ring, trying to get to the Cornettes of the Worlds and trying to get to DiBiase? And I always thought it was so crazy because you look at the smallest guy in the world coming down wanting to jump in Dr. Death's face.
Yeah, that's far.
Okay. Yeah, there's 20 of you here, and I don't think that's a good idea.
Were you at TV tonight in Tulsa where some fan got real close to Cornette as he was leaving with heat? Legitimate heat, not go-away heat, not eye-rolling heat. He, like, you got me. I'm pissed off right now. I really am mad. I know it's pro wrestling, but I'm mad. Let him watch what happened. And somebody got too close to him and nailed him right perfectly in the nose. And it looked like a tomato, just, you know, all kinds of liquid and shit coming out of it.
Motherfucker.
And man, oh, yeah, that's it. You got it, man. He was cutting promos of every son of a bitch in the world. He was going to fight everybody in the building one at a time. You know, that dangerous tennis racket. He was so damn angry. But what it showed was this son of a bitch is passionate about what he does. He made them mad. He made them so mad that they reacted in a negative and physical way. In a way, that's a great sign of success. If you're a villain, you're a heel. A heel, goddamn it. You know.
Yes.
Him and Kenny.
Kenny.
So, Kenny's out Jerry Lawler. Kid Chucky Fargo, I fucking bloody snub my mother spanked my ass. That was such a good experience for us. Car trips are good. Their car trips are classrooms, Bruce.
Yes,
you had to stop every few hours because you know you didn't have to drive across country to go to some of these towns. Once you got down in the Louisiana area, they were pretty. You know, they weren't bad, but they were good. They were every day. point is that the trips allowed everybody to communicate a little bit. We didn't have cell phones. At least I didn't have one. I don't know anybody else. I think Cowboy may have had one or something. Not a cell phone, but a, what do you call it?
Well, a satellite, phone. Big, yeah.
Yeah. Of course, whatever cost the most he had. But I had those great times there. You know, riding with the guys like Danny Hodge or Skandar Akbar or all these other cats or Cowboy. Cowboy liked me to drive because he didn't have to drive. And because at that time, I had the ability to roll a nice joint while steering the car with my legs. And so I could roll a nice tight joint, and then that's all, you know. He wanted me to roll in two or three for later, and so for his relaxing time. So but it was just he was spoiled. He wanted a burger, which he got a burger. I guarantee you one thing, man. When Danny Hodge got the sweet tooth all over him and he needed chocolate, your ass better find chocolate. That's all I can tell you. Don't compromise. Find the man the chocolate, or he starts becoming a little bit unhinged. And the last thing you want is to be caught in a car with only you and Danny Hodge with him unhinged. Not cool.
What would he do?
Oh, he started breaking shit. He might grab the rearview mirror. He wanted a Dairy Queen. He wanted a milkshake. We're right outside Shreveport. We're going to TV. And he was late meeting me at the office in Tulsa. So I'd already driven like 5 hours or six. He wanted, and he'd been sleeping most of the time. And, he wanted a milkshake from Dairy Queen. And it's got to be Dairy Queen. Oh, Jesus. Well, hell, I don't know where we were, Marshall Tech. I don't know, someplace down there. I didn't know where Dairy Queens were around there. Didn't have I couldn't ask Alexa. There wasn't no Alexa. So I told him, I said, God damn it, Danny, I'll find one. I promise I'll stop. And he grabbed like he would turn the signal light on, but inside that had the cruise control mechanism. He pushed a little button. Of course, his strength, he don't have a clue how strong he is. So he pushes the goddamn cruise control button so far into the deal, it broke it. So I just realized that to prevent my personal property from being destroyed, and then next would be me. Because what he would do, he grabbed me by the wrist with his thumb and his forefinger. That's all he needed. And you would write bad checks. You would do all kinds of very sad things if you just let go of your goddamn wrist. Because the pain was nothing like I have ever experienced. And I've had colonoscopies, and I've had surgeries. I've broken bones, ribs, blah, blah, blah. Nothing compares to that. Because he would get that thumb and forefinger on your wrist, Bruce, and he'd just roll it. And it felt like you're getting shocked with the electric bolts. It was horrible.
Unfortunately, have experienced that because you assholes got him to do that the very first time that I met him. Show Bruce, yeah. In Little Rock, Arkansas, was the first time that I met Danny Hodge. That's how impressionable that he was on me. You know, Danny Hodge is kind of like a southern version of Stu Hart.
Yeah.
As far as
probably.
Torture.
And they're both are wonderful men as far as just being good people. You know, Stu had a great heart, helped a lot of guys.
Yep.
Had that wonderful big family of his. But Danny was, Danny's accolades in amateur wrestling are, after all these years, are still untouched. You know, they named the Heisman Trophy is named after that's given to the best college football player in America, the Heisman. And, the Dan Hodge Award is the same thing in amateur wrestling. So their top award is the Hodge Award. And, so he's very, very revered, but he was a real interesting cat, man. And, but I'd never been around. I still haven't been around anybody like him. I thought at one time that Kurt Angle was going to be close to Hodge. Now, Kurt was a better pro wrestler than Danny. He adapted to being a better pro, I thought. But as far as if you got him in a room and only one was going to walk out, I got to go with Hodge because he has that screw loose. Yeah, that screw loose man. Hey, that's like I refereed a match one time, Bruce, in that Mid-South era, or even before that, with Jack Briscoe and Danny Hodge in Little Rock, by the way, at Barton Coliseum, and they went an hour. And so Danny would have these moments of clarity where he would sometimes he'd start selling and he'd get really wrapped up into the process. In other words, he believed his own shit. So he was selling, and then he would worry about, like the guys today, the reason they don't want to sell much, they want to look weak because they don't know how to sell. They won't admit that because that's, how could they admit that, that they don't really know how to work? I see them, you see them that way every, on every TV show, you see guys like that.
Exactly.
So, you know, you do. You know, it's what the hell. They got jobs, good for them. But Hodge was, he was just a, he worked on Jack. We're about 45 or 50 minutes in this thing, and the crowd was wanting Danny to make a comeback. So Jack was the champion and going to retain with a draw. But Jack had to, calm Danny down because the crowd was getting restless as far as the, it was working. They wanted, Hodge was selling in a real good way. And I've been refereed matches for him where I said, Danny, you okay? And he'd go, you know, laugh. You sadistic bastard. Boy, you something else. And so I remember Jack telling Hodge, Danny, if you'll just let go of my wrist, I'll give you this goddamn belt. Loosen up. And then Danny would say, I'm sorry, Jack. I'm sorry. You know, his little baby voice. But he didn't know what he was doing. So I'm just thinking that somebody says, well, you know he couldn't whip Brock Lesnar. So I don't know that. I don't know that. Because I don't know what price Brock Lesnar would be willing to pay to survive Danny Hodge. And vice versa, for that matter. Yeah. I just don't believe that. He's a different cat, brother, a different breed of cats. But that was what I got broken into with, too. And, you know, you had those bigger-than-life characters in Houston. You know, all those great Bull Currys and all those dudes. I love those dudes. That's a real, honest-to-goodness, bigger-than-life characters that we got to be hanging around and just listen to, and it was wonderful.
Yeah, I think that some of the best moments in my life were moments, for example, Mark Lewin and Killer Carl Cox sitting in the dressing room just talking and telling stories. Like, they hadn't seen each other in years, and they were catching up. I don't even think I was 16, 17 years old, and just a fly on a wall. I was just sitting there. It was just the three of us, but I was amazed at some of the things that they talked about just so nonchalantly. But that's how we learned.
Without a doubt. And Bruce, you know, the other thing it speaks to is that if they were good verbal storytellers and you were kind of entranced and really feeling good about what you're hearing and entertained, interested, whatever, if they could do that verbally, then there's no reason that those skills can't transfer into telling a physical story. If you understand the direction you're going in and how do you tell a story? I think that those guys are, that's why they're so good in the ring. I always believed, and I thought it's in the Mid-South era, that Carl Cox is the most underrated guys that we have in the roster, because I don't know that I've seen a better fundamental heel than him. Than when he turned babyface, that's where I learned what a character babyface was. Carl Cox, when he turned babyface in Mid-South, was a character babyface.
And the audience, they believed him. They believed in him.
You better. I remember he had a big program with Murdoch, and Murdoch was the babyface. And Murdoch was on one of his nights. I remember it was in Baton Rouge at the Centerplex. Of course, no matter what the house was, it was $10,600 gross. It's almost 10-6. That's what they called Jimmy Killshaw, the promoter, 10-6. He was 10-6 because the house could be full, 10-6. Could be three-fourths full, 10-6. So anyway, 10-6 was there, and they had this match. They had a nice house, and Cox was really trying to get this thing over. And so, but Dickie was there on a night where he wanted to be Shemp of the Three Stooges. So he was ready to do all his Three Stooges stuff. but he would have had to do them a cappella and probably unconsciously, because he's farting around, he's doing the Three Stooges shit, which is brilliant, and he's funnier than hell, but it wasn't a comedy match. It was a blood feud, these two son of bitches. And so then Murdoch pushes Cox back into the corner, and he's getting ready to do all this Stooges stuff, you know, the woo-woo-woo-woo, all that shit. What are you doing? I'm refereeing. And Cox reverses it. So now Murdoch's in next to the turnbuckle, and Cox is on the outside. And Cox, I'd always heard Rocky Marciano could do this. Cox had about a 6-inch punch, Bruce, that he used that on that occasion, that moment. About a 6-inch punch. And I have never seen the noise, heard the noise or seen the results more profoundly than that 6-inch punch right to the jaw of Dick Murdoch. Murdoch's legs went limp. And Cox got both arms under Murdoch's arms to hold him up because he didn't want him taking a bump. And he told him, says, get serious, you son of a bitch, or you know, what, or something along those lines. And I don't know if Murdoch could even understand him. But I can tell you this, it got Dickie's attention. And we both know that when Murdoch was on, he was really on. And they had as good a match, the rest of that match, as I ever saw. And it was real and believable. And even the naysayers sitting at ringside who just came to see if they could find the rabbit up their sleeve or whatever, they're in awe. Because these some of them are laying their stuff in, which I don't see a lot today either. You know, guys want to be unsafe, but goddamn, some of the punches I see wouldn't even break an egg.
Right.
Those guys broke eggs. They broke eggs, Brucey. They broke eggs in Baton Rouge.
They sure did. Who's your, okay, and I'm going to let you go here a little bit, but Jim, your favorite booker that you got to work with? Mid-South.
Oh, booker. Well, you know, I'll give you an answer, but they all had their positives. I liked Dundee's boldness and his creativity and retooling things that were done in Memphis to the roster in the Mid-South. He did a really great job, especially considering that he had much rather been wrestling than booking, except maybe for the money. I loved Ernie from a kind of a spiritual Black history type thing, football, all that shit. And of course we bonded over dominoes. Cause Ernie and I played dominoes in my room and smoked cigarettes, and whatever. After we wrote TV on Tuesday night, Cowboy would go to bed and, then we'd go to my room and smoke it up and play dominoes all night. And literally, seriously, all night is not exaggeration. At least at 4 or 5 in the morning. So, Ken Mantell was I like Kenny personally. I guess, business wise, Dundee would be the top guy because he drew the most money. But Ernie was right there with it. But what Ernie taught me as a future administrator and somebody that would be working with talent was very valuable, Bruce. I mean, especially as it relates to dealing with African American athletes. The bottom line of all that is real simple. Just be honest.
Yep.
And I know that's an oxymoron in wrestling. Just be honest.
But the crazy thing is when you're on, when you are the most honest is when people think you're bullshitting them.
Yeah. I know. Hey, how many times have people, I see this all the time, not all the time, I'm exaggerating. I see it too frequently, I'd say that, where some talents would blame you for their WWE experience because they don't want to burn the bridge with the old man.
Right.
I get that all. I'm sure you do too. I get it all the time from someone I hear, well, so-and-so did an interview. He really blasted you how you did such and such. Or, you know, you and I were talking the other day about the that weekend in Cleveland where Jeff Jarrett, you know, was leaving and unannounced, and he put China over, blah, blah, blah. And it'll be in my next book. But, you know, you just don't, you're not trained for some of this shit. You know, you don't know how this is going to go down. And the business is dicey, brother. I'm telling you, it's better today than it has been. And I think we can both say yes to that, because here are two guys like you and me that don't take bumps. At least you have, I have, I'm not good at it, Cal and Ice-like. I'll just ask you a question. I used to think that in WWE, in the creative side, that some of the angles that they did with me were almost like an inside joke more than great creative. Is that just my ego saying that, or is that anything? Is there any validity to that, Bruce?
I think there's some validity to it. I also think that it, especially when it was done in Oklahoma, it was done to, well, you want to get somebody over there, and especially for a heel, let's do it with JR because it's home, it's going to mean more, and do it. And I do think that a lot of times, we're having fun at your expense. And sometimes I think it was mean-spirited under the guise of creative liberties and things of that
artistic
nature.
Artistic license.
But the Mr. Heine and that bullshit and Dr. Heine. Yeah, Dr. Heine with Vince. Yeah. And they wanted me to fly from Houston to go up and produce that segment. And I was on the phone and I said, you have 8 people in that room right now. 2 of who came up with that idea of what they want to see and how this is going to happen. Vince is sitting there as I'm saying this. I said, why do you want to spend over $1,000 to fly me up for a 1-day shoot that's for a segment that's going to last a couple of minutes?
Yeah, and it closed the show. That's what made me think it was a little personal.
I was like,
why would you put that on the segment 11 back in the day? It was a money segment. I didn't understand that. I thought it was not a good utilization, Bruce, of the television time. You know, I didn't like it. I was sick at that time, and I had, had the illness. A lot of things were up in the air there, too. It hurt Jan's feelings more than anything, which kind of pissed me off, because nobody thinks about anybody else but them and getting their own self over. Boy, this is fun. This is going to go piss JR off. This is going to be good. Yeah, he's somebody sitting home. He's screwed up, man. You know, you get 13 inches of your intestines removed from your fucking body, you know, and your children and your wife are wondering if you're going to be all right. They ain't good TV.
Yeah, but I also do believe, and this is the sick perversion in me, that I truly do believe this. I think that in Vince's head, it was an homage. Goddamn, JR will get a kick out of this.
He did say that.
That he looked at it as a loving thing, that we're going to make fun of you, we're going to have fun with this because we love you.
Yeah.
And I think in his head, he really believes that. I think that as it got the shit in there, some of it was just mean-spirited and crazy, and I thank God that one I can say I had nothing to do with. No. And,
yeah. Well, hey, look, it was buddy. I'm not angry, but I just thought it was nothing. It was somewhat irresponsible as far as the position. Should have gone on the show. If you want the show, put it in the show, but why would you put it on the last? If I was in the talent and I was, and my angles, my storylines were not going to be underscored or focused on going off the air, and you're going to do this bit, nurse slobber knockers and all that, then I'd be pissed off too, because that's a valuable selling segment. And we weren't doing, that was not an angle. We weren't going to do anything with that.
That was a ha-ha one-off.
That's all it was. Yeah. That's all it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's all it was. But
we're talking about bookers. I got a question for you. You ever work with Buck Robley?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
What did you think
He's
of
good.
Him?
Great ideas. A really great idea guy. But I never got over the hump of being able to fully trust him. He always seemed a little slippery to me and a little shady. He was quite the character. But he had a great feel for the business, especially how to book a heel. And if you learn how to book a heel and get them over an overheel, then building the baby faces to match up with them is not nearly as difficult. If you're trying to build both at the same time, you don't have an established heel, and you're trying to build a baby face parallel with that, sometimes it's the fate of conflict. It's not going to get over because neither one of them are over yet. And you can't get over it unless you're working somebody that's over to some degree, as you know. But Buck was good, man. He really could book heels. He could put great finishes with heat. But, you know, Buck liked to party. And so if you just eliminate all that and just go by his product knowledge and his creativity, he was really, really good. I'm glad you brought him up because I forgot about that.
Yeah, Buck was one of those guys that took time with me and explained why he did things.
Yeah, me too. I'm with you. Yeah, you're right.
I love that. But I, like you say, it's all of his extenuating circumstances and how he handled things once he left the building that were questionable at best.
Right.
So, yeah. Best baby face, Jim. Mid-South.
Wow. Well, there's some good ones there.
I thought that there would be one at the top. It would just pop out.
Probably Dog.
Yes. Okay. You didn't disappoint me then.
No.
But there were great
JYD ones. The thing about Ernie Ladd convinced JYD that a 285-pound baby face, even if you might be working with a 225-pound heel, can and should still sell. So one of the things that I always thought was great and why Duck Chop Dog was a good baby face, number one, to be a heel, you got to feed a comeback and take multiple bumps. That ain't him. Feeding a comeback don't fit JYD's description. And he's not an acrobat, so he's not going to be doing head scissors and drop kicks and hurricane runners. So what do? Well, if people believe in you, you show that you can fight, and you never let them down. And that was JYD there. He sold, and he didn't die sell. He sold. Now, I've been in the locker room where he sold too much, and Cowboy would chew his ass out. I think Cowboy was going to fire Lynn Denton on the spot for making Dog look bad on a TV match. And we had to protect him, but if you protected your investment with him, he was the top baby face. Sold more merchandise, you know, even though it was a very archaic system then. I remember designing the shirt for Buck Rowley that says, "Nobody calls me yellow."
Right.
You remember that t-shirt he wore, the arm brace and all that stuff?
Sure do.
Yeah, "Nobody calls me yellow." And I did two or three more. I did a Cowboy shirt, Last Stampede shirt. I did something else. For Murdoch. I had Murdoch won a State of Texas Outline. I can't do that. Oklahoma, I can't do that, Dickie. You sell t-shirts, you'll do it, because I ain't going to buy much money. The State of Texas is on there. It's okay. So we did it, obviously. I was going to do it all along. But JY was the guy, man. JYD was the guy. And then he got lazy. He ate too many Hershey bars. Late at night, Pee Wee Anderson, and his massive bag of quarters. We know how that all ended, you know. And I didn't like the way he left. I thought he owed Bill more than that, because Bill had made him a lot of money. Bill had bought him cars and all kinds of shit. Took care of him. Helped him with his taxes. You know, just all, like a father would do a son. Or, you know, an uncle or do a nephew or something like that. Hell, I don't know. But he Cowboy, with all his bad points, Brucey, we both experienced all of them. We've seen the worst of him and the best of him, that he deserved better than not getting a notice from this top guy that he made a national star.
Yep.
And I don't know what he would have done with it, but, you know, he could have gotten somebody, one match, get somebody over, you know, and it just didn't happen. But,
you know, I think I had the first spot show after JYD left, and it was Dog and Butch Reed on top in Beaumont, yep, Texas. And I think it was Bill had just found out that Dog was gone, and I don't even remember who the hell we had sent to us. But when I got the news, I said, "I've got an idea." I said, "What's that?" I said, "How about if we send Butch to the Reed?" And they were doing street fights at the time, and Butch's music was taking it to the streets. And I said, "Let's get Butch in the ring, and then we just start JYD's music, and we all leave." "What the fuck did you do?" I said, "That there, that's my idea." And Bill didn't think that was a very good idea or a good comment at the time, considering the circumstances.
Was I kicking me from underneath the table?
Oh God, yeah.
No, Bruce.
Don't go there. Just stop. He's pissed. He's fucking pissed.
He got his feelings hurt.
Yeah.
The big bastard. We've seen him pissed a lot of times. Over a bet. I saw him get pissed one day. We moved to hotels because the goddamn croissants weren't buttery and flaky enough. He said, we're not staying here anymore. Why? It's great. The nice hotel, this little hotel by the airport, Streetport, all day in, I think. They had remote control. That was unheard of. So my fat ass did not have to get up and go change my channel. I had remote control. It was wonderful. But we left because the croissants at breakfast were not buttery and flaky enough for the cowboy. So we bolted there. So, his feelings were hurt. That's what that deal was. I think he knew all along. You know, I'm sure you and I had this conversation. The answer to that conundrum with dog leaving was under our nose. Butch Reed. People believed in Butch. You could do the Butch Reed thing could have been just as easy as getting a foreigner, quote unquote, heel to turn on him and him. He might be a no good bastard, but he's our no good bastard, and he's going to stand up for America. Blah blah. I don't know, it's a bit boring, maybe, but it gives you a logical reason for two guys to have a rivalry and then finally get to a match. But God, how many black guys we try? I felt bad for him because it's the old story of Cthulhu replacing Jimmy Snuka. Ain't gonna work.
Nope.
Ain't gonna work, buddy.
And
Jewel Strongbow replacing Chief J Strongbow.
Yeah.
Ain't gonna work.
And we had Duggan underneath our nose too.
Absolutely. And he was getting over like a son of a bitch.
God.
Dog Lever was the best thing that ever happened to Hacksaw Jim Duggan because he moved right to that top spot and he'd earned it. And he was exactly the kind of baby faced cowboy admired and embraced. Big, rugged, gruff, no backup, no reverse gear. Let's fight. I'm telling you right now, sometimes when I get a nostalgic moment, one of my favorite matches from Mid-South to watch are some of the matches involving Jim Duggan and Buzz Sawyer.
Good God, yes.
And the way Buzz Sawyer could, when Buzz Sawyer fed the comeback, it was extraordinary. Really, really good stuff. So, hey, we could talk about this all day, buddy. I'm thinking somewhere down the road, there's been a lot of books written about Mid-South, but it's kind of got a cult following. I'm going to research that one of these days. That might be something fun to mess with. Because I keep saying I want to do less work, and I keep adding shit to my plate. This is not a good combination.
Nah, you got to. So, okay, and we'll close on this, Jim. You're doing a second book. What are they going to expect out of the second book?
Well, it's going to pick up chronologically where the first book left off, which was me returning to WrestleMania and after a long bout of Bell's palsy, my mother passing away, serious Bell's palsy with that second deal for sure. And it was rocking. Austin won in, I guess, was that Philly or Boston? Philly, I think.
Philly.
Yeah. And so I came back and did the last match. So that's where we ended the first book. The second book will pick up soon thereafter. It will cover such things as the Monday Night Wars, the company almost going bankrupt, the company going public, the original XFL, the Austin era beginning and ending, the evolution of The Rock, all that stuff during that time, the me leaving from after being told I was not going to be broken up with Lawler on Raw, and the next day being broken up with Lawler on Raw, going to SmackDown as Todd Grisham's sidekick. Things like that. It's not a sad book. It's got great stories in it, great lessons, and a lot of humor. And it also includes, Bruce, obviously this will cover Jan's passing, my thoughts at that time and what I went through. It wasn't a pretty sight. I was really, really lucky. I didn't screw up big time with her after she died. I was drinking too much, and I was feeling sorry for myself. And everything I detest about others, I was doing. So I'm going to talk about that and how you get around it a little bit or deal with it. So it's going to be good. And then who knows what's going to happen between now and Tommy finish this book. So it's got a lot of good stuff in it, and I'm looking forward to telling it. It's going to be, so it's kind of deep, but it's truth and it's real. And sometimes that don't hurt.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, Jim, and I cannot thank you enough. I told you we do 30, 40 minutes, and we've done over an hour, man, and I love talking to you. We'll do it again sometime. We'll pick another subject because I think you and I could go on forever and ever, man, and I love you, and I greatly appreciate it, man, and I know you got to get off and get some dentist stuff done and other things done today. I appreciate you taking the time and hanging with us and sharing some old stories.
My pleasure, buddy. Anything for you, anytime.
All right, man. Take care.
All right.